This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome everybody to Jikoji Zen Center, especially if this is your first time. This is our typical Sunday program. My name is Nicholas Chikudo Howells. Chikudo is my Dharma name that was given to me by my Zen teacher, Ryushin Paul Haller. Chikudo means bamboo way. I'm not a Zen teacher. I'm just a student. This cloth here around my neck is a rakusu, which is meant to be kind of like a compact version of the robe the Buddha wore. And my wearing it just represents my having made the decision to be a child of the Buddha, and to take refuge in the Buddha, and to practice Zen. So it doesn't, there's no qualifications for having this. So it's not typical that somebody with my lack of teaching credentials would give a talk, but this talk will be a way-seeking mind talk, which is just sort of my story of coming to Zen practice. And so sort of talking about my life. And so, you know, please take what I say with a grain of salt, because I'm not a Zen teacher. But thank you very much for listening, and to the Sangha for giving this opportunity, to Dro for giving me this spot this weekend, and to all the Jikoji management for giving me this opportunity to talk. So I'll try to get through. Practicing Zen, you hear many way-seeking mind talks, and it's a common fallacy to spend entire time talking about the first, you know, 15 years of your life, and then you don't actually get through to how old you are now. I'm 39 now, so you know, we got a little territory to cover here. So I'll do my best. I was born in 1984 in Chico, California, which is just a couple hours northeast of here. My parents are Jeff and Claudia, and I have one brother who is a year older than me, named Pete. I was born in Chico. A few years later, we moved up to Paradise, California, where we lived for a few years before settling in an area in between Chico and Paradise called Butte Creek Canyon. When I was maybe 5 or 6, we moved there. Butte Creek Canyon is it's a beautiful natural area, a lot like Jikoji. It looks almost identical to Jikoji, except it's kind of a big, wide canyon, maybe half as many trees, drier, but there's a big creek that runs through the canyon. And when my family bought that land, there wasn't anything there. And so my dad, having trained in antique home restoration, he built all the buildings there from scratch. He had some help, but he was very capable craftsman, and he liked to kind of do things himself. And he built our family, like the first buildings were kind of rustic, so a lot like Jikoji. I'm not saying it's rustic, but so in many ways where I grew up was a lot like Jikoji, and with all the advantages, it was like very peaceful, no crime. You know, there weren't many, we had neighbors, maybe closer than the neighbors here, but not many neighbors. So, you know, I grew up kind of like in this sort of forest area, which was really beautiful and such a blessing. I had a pretty amazing childhood in a lot of ways, although we were, you know, I didn't have much contact with the civilized world. We would go, the town of Chico was just 20 minutes away, and we would go there often, you know, but it's, suburbia and like a normal city, it seemed to be this kind of foreign thing to me. And our home was kind of more with the oak trees and bay trees and you know, more rural. So I feel very lucky that I had that upbringing. And we had a small, simple house. Like, we didn't have a big house for the first 6 years, but in those 6 years, my dad made like a second house adjacent to the first house, which took him a long time, and we all kind of helped. So we grew up kind of doing construction and helping in little ways. My dad take care of the house and take care of the property, you know, cutting trees and clearing brush and stuff like that. kind of a somewhat rugged rural life, although I also like to play video games and I didn't always work that much. So, but in the kind of first 6 years we were there, my dad built this house, which was this real work of art. The walls are made out of rammed earth, which is like kind of foot thick mud and cement. So it kind of looks like adobe. And it acts like a giant refrigerator because it's like this thick mud. It's kind of like a house cave. And the roof was this beautiful pine beam roof. And he put mud on the roof and grew grass on the roof to keep the house cold. It has this kind of evaporative cooling thing. House was absolutely a work of art, and very much a labor of love from my whole family. My mom, both my parents were there 100% of the time. There was, you know, it was a very peaceful and stable household. Both my parents were raised in religious household. My mom was raised Catholic. My dad was raised Mormon. But they kind of came to age in the 1960s and adopted the kind of hippie mentality of kind of counterculture, very much so in the case of my dad, like very countercultural viewpoint, very anti-religion. So I grew up in a house pretty much without religion, without any organized religion. We didn't go to church and we weren't indoctrinated with anything. Parents both had a deep respect for kind of broader spiritual cultures, including Asian culture and Asian philosophy. And they didn't necessarily like teach us anything specific, but in our house, it was kind of almost like Eastern religion was held in as high regard or maybe higher regard than Western religion, because my parents had kind of found peace and moving away from that culture that they had. In the 1960s with the Vietnam War, it was seen as sort of bad, you know, like my dad did mention, you know, having his friends sent to Vietnam and killed, you know, in his view, by the establishment. And so to various degrees, that was kind of what they were raised in. And so they didn't have a strong, certainly my dad didn't have like a strong respect for the establishment. And so we kind of lived on the fringes of the city and on the fringes of, you know, philosophy. And so, yeah, my childhood, like my decision to become a Zen Buddhist was not the least bit controversial, really, and was supported by my parents, and they supported me to do whatever I wanted. And so I'm incredibly grateful for that. I was incredibly fortunate to have been free from any sort of, you know, being forced to do anything just because they wanted me to do it. Growing up, we didn't suffer from crime or anything, but there was kind of natural disasters. My family survived a wildfire that surrounded our home, and we kind of had to hide in the garage. And later there was a flood that knocked down our bridge. But there was kind of like scary moments like that, but we always got through them. My parents were very resourceful. You know, bridge fell down and put up a new one. And after these disasters, things always seemed to get better. Like, you know, we'd transform the forest and life would come back and things, we kept building our house and things always seemed to get better after that. 10 minutes. Okay. When I was young, I became interested in what my mind did as I fell asleep. I don't know why. I think my mom, she wanted us to succeed. She had grown up in a kind of a bigger family, and they didn't have a lot of money. She didn't have a chance to go to college. And so I think she really wanted us to succeed. And so at one point she like would play these meditations for us, kind of guided meditations that like motivate us, which involve some kind of like guided meditations to fall asleep. Anyway, when I was young, I started to get interested in like what happened to my mind as I fell asleep. And I would sort of like kind of consciously watch my mind as I kind of, you know, dissolved into slumber, and my mind become kind of a jumble, you know, like thoughts would merge into other thoughts, and I couldn't hold on to a thought and just kind of blissfully as a child fall asleep. And so I became interested in this. I don't know. I just became interested in my mind falling asleep and also like being able to visualize things in my mind with my eyes closed. I was born with pectus excavatum, which means my sternum was reversed at birth, and my chest was this kind of pretty pronounced bowl shape.
Oh. can anybody hear me on Zoom? No?
Maybe I can do this. Thank you, Chuck, for can people on Zoom hear me?
Oh dear. Can people on Zoom hear me?
Can hear you quite well, Nick.
Okay. So maybe Adam, I think it's you, not us. All right. I know Adam. Okay. So, okay. They can hear me. I was born with profound pectus excavatum, and it's a very common condition, but mine was very pronounced. And so at some point I had a lot of breathing problems and the doctors thought surgery was important for me. So when I was in high school, I had like major corrective surgery on my chest. Growing up with that pectus excavatum, it made me feel, cause it was severe and like other kids would, if you took a shirt off, they would kind of point at you. And I felt, you know, nobody bullied me a lot for it cause mostly you couldn't see it, but it gave me the sense that I was kind of like odd or not right or feeble or something, you know, that there was something wrong with me. And so when the doctors suggested surgery, I was all for it purely for vanity reasons. But I think they thought it might impact my heart and lung development. And so I was in high school, I had this major operation where they cut my chest open. I was under anesthesia for like 5 hours, I think, for a long time. And then I, you know, woke up in the hospital room after that. it was in a hospital, not a hotel. that would have been a story. They cut my chest open. I woke up in the hospital and I was on morphine and just, I'd never experienced anything like that. And that was like a pretty big transition for me. And it happened at a time when I was mentally developing, you know, in high school. And that was difficult. It was difficult for me to get through that. And it was difficult to understand what happens in anesthesia. And it was kind of a dark couple of months after that. But within a year, like I felt pretty good. And, you know, I felt like I'd been made whole somehow. I don't know. Like I felt really good about it afterwards. Although my chest has always been kind of unusual because it's a little bit numb and broken up, but that had a big effect on me. In high school, in the junior year of high school, I met my first girlfriend and we had a relationship that lasted like a year or so. And it was like kind of like unbelievably good for me. And it really, that relationship with my first girlfriend really pulled me out of maybe a very dark place. And she really kind of got me on track academically. And that was the first time I ever knew like real like love, or I just felt so amazing in that relationship. And I'm so deeply grateful for that. At the end of high school, we broke up and that was really hard for me. I had kind of struggled with depression, maybe after the surgery or during, like kind of all through high school, but that relationship had a profound effect on me and was kind of like one of the best things that happened to me when I was young. At some point in high school, I started, I had to take allergy. I had to take allergy because I had these breathing problems. I had to take allergy shots. So I'd have to get up early, go to the allergist and get these injections in my arm. And it was either the allergen or they may have put some kind of like antihistamine in the shot itself. But I would have to go to school after that super early in the morning and I would fall asleep in class. Like I just couldn't keep my eyes open because I had to get up early. But that was my first experience slacking in class, but also that was the first time I experienced like lucid dreaming phenomena. I would go to class, like put my head on the desk, and like it wasn't like 100%. It was rare, but like I would put my head on the desk and experience, you know, conscious dreaming. Once it was like kind of, it felt like you could see remotely. And it was like just a little bit. That was the first time I had sort of like lucid dreaming phenomenon. After high school, I went to school at UC Davis. I was very lucky. Attend UC Davis. And when I went, one of the first things I did was go to the library there and go to the Eastern religion section and start to look at books like on Taoism, consciousness, Zen. I kind of gravitated towards Taoism because it was like simple and something that I felt connected to. I found a book in the library called Getting There Without Drugs. And it was a book on, I don't know what he meant by there, but it was a book that started, it was written at the Esalen Institute. It was a book that started with consciousness exercises. Like it would say like, listen, like get a piece of paper and sit and listen and write down as many sounds as you can hear, you know, bird chirping, car driving by, and write them down as you understand them. And like write down as many as you can, find as many little sounds as you can. And then next, listen to the sounds and don't write down the name. Don't write down car, write down like whirring engine or write down or like tires on the road or like I hear gravel. And then next step is like, don't write down like descriptions of what it sounds like. Just write down the sound like grr or buzz, you know, kind of getting to like direct contact with the sound without putting all these layers of concepts and thinking on top. And I was doing that exercise from this book, and it was like really kind of like, maybe that was my first like real experience with some sort of consciousness exercise. And I continued to practice that both with like hearing and seeing, like, what are you actually seeing? Like how many colors do you actually see on the table? You know, what do you, how many lines do you actually see? It's kind of like mindfulness or consciousness through hearing and seeing. Right away, and I gotta speed this up, right away, I joined an Aikido class. Aikido is a Japanese martial art, and I met my first Aikido teacher, Sensei David Burt, who passed away last year. I just found that out a couple of days ago, actually. I put his name up there on the altar, and I feel like this talk is sort of an honor and dedication to him. But he was, he had a huge impact on my life. He was dedicated, serious spiritual practitioner and Aikidoist, and he really kind of like formed, you know, like the second phase of my life with his seriousness about Aikido, the intensity and like the dignity and the morality that he brought to Aikido, and like how much he pushed us in that practice. And he was the one who actually first taught me to sit meditation just briefly, kind of at the end of college, and he was the one that told me to go to the San Francisco Zen Center at the end of college. And so that was like my first introduction to Zen, was through this practice of Aikido. He had enormous impact on my life. And he was really my first spiritual teacher. And I really just, Aikido was my religion and it meant everything to me. When I was young, when I was 8 years old, I got hit in the face with a baseball bat. Me and my brother were screwing around, totally an accident. but I get clocked in the face with a metal baseball bat here in my left cheek. I was fine. I probably kind of made a scar in my brain. And when I started to practice Aikido, I had a couple of accidents where somebody kind of accidentally or something kicked me in the face. And then later again, like a year later. And so that was kind of the beginning of this concussion syndrome that I still battle with today. And that concussion syndrome kind of put an end to my Aikido practice. My head just became so sensitive, and that's why I can't bow with my head on the ground, that even a little bump could cause this sort of concussion reaction that's taken me a long time, a lot of effort to navigate and to diagnose. In college, I had this experience of my friend inviting me. My friend lived in Sacramento, my friend Mike. He invited me one weekend to come to his house and take psychedelic mushrooms with them. I had no idea what I was doing. But I went to his house. It was an apartment in Sacramento. And we took like a full dose, like 3.5 grams of mushrooms, chased it with some orange juice or something like that. I was completely unprepared for that experience. When I was younger, I had read this book. My dad actually gave me this book, Carlos Castaneda book, Yaqui Way of Knowledge. And I had this like deep idea, deep respect for plant medicine, psychedelic drugs. But it was more of just kind of a fiction or a fantasy. But when we took these mushrooms, like we just took the mushrooms, we left his apartment, and we started to walk along the Sacramento River. And it started to be kind of like a magical experience. And then it became like a profoundly psychedelic experience. And then it became like a profoundly religious experience. And it was like kind of deeper and deeper and deeper as it goes. We went to our friend Corbin's brother's house, and we went inside the apartment. We were in nature, which is good. We went to his apartment, which is can be overstimulating. I looked into his backyard, and he had this backyard with his tree and his bike. And it looked like my backyard from my old apartment. And I looked at the bike, and it looked like my old bike. And I saw the bike, and I was like very much feeling the effect of the mushrooms, which was way, way not prepared for. I looked at the bike and I thought, like, is that my bike? And then I thought, like, where am I? I was like suddenly kind of like going with the experience, and I'm kind of trying to get out of the experience. I went, where am I? And I thought, I'm in Sacramento. And then I thought, like, what is Sacramento? My mind was just totally breaking down. Like, I didn't know if the bike was mine. I didn't know what's that. Like, I saw clearly that Sacramento had no basis. There was no Sacramento. Like, the world has no basis. I didn't know what was my home or what was real, where it came from. I took, you know, a lot, and my mind was totally breaking down. I sat down in Seiza, and my hands just like balled up like rigor mortis, and like my body started to seize up like I was dying. I was just totally freaking out. And there was this kind of like experience of like, not like quite like a light and I'm dying, but I was freaking out, and all basis of my knowledge was like leaving me. And it was this kind of experience of dying that I tried to run from. Anyway, like I was able to get through the experience, but that, and then like later, like a few weeks later, my friend gave me some cannabis and I was smoking weed, and I kind of went back in that experience. And it was this thing where like reality itself was like breaking down for me. And with the mushrooms, like I kind of got out of it with the cannabis, I couldn't get out of it. And it was like my world broke down. And like, I was like, it felt like I was high for like months. Like I went to this dark place and I was just lost, and I couldn't talk to anybody. And it was a very dark place. And I thought, like, I don't know if I can take this. I'll have to end my life. Like I can't, like I broke down reality. But in that, I was able to find kind of this light inside myself. And I realized like I didn't know anything, but I knew that what really mattered was what I wanted. And what I wanted was to live and to succeed in life. And so it was kind of a different way. Like the mind doesn't have any basis of reality, but there was this kind of basis of reality in my spirit or heart where it's like, I didn't care if this was a dream or if this was real, but like, I wanted to live and I wanted to succeed and I wanted, you know, to enjoy life. Those things led me eventually, my Aikido teacher told me, go to the San Francisco Zen Center. So I don't think I would have made it there if he hadn't told me. I went there for a week just as a guest student. And there, that was my first real experience of Zen, practicing, doing chores at San Francisco Zen Center. Later I went to Tassajara, also doing the same thing for a couple of weeks. You can go to Tassajara work period. And then the following year I went to my first sesshin at San Francisco Zen Center. And I had started a relationship, with a girl in the summer, and it was very intense and kind of tumultuous. And I just couldn't feel, she was wonderful. And I was like deeply in love with her. I just couldn't feel happy. I couldn't feel at peace. And so we were kind of breaking up, and I went to San Francisco in the spring, and I was staying with her at her apartment as we were like breaking up. And I was staying in the Castro where she lived, and I would walk to City Center every morning to attend a sesshin. A sesshin is where you do a full week of meditation. It's very rigorous. You wake up very early, you sit in meditation all day. It was my first experience with meditation, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't think I'd get through it, but I just kind of was muscling through it with this kind of Aikido, like wrestling spirit, just like, do it. On the morning of the fourth day, I had to wake up early, and I would like walk very quickly from the Castro to city center, you know, 15, 20 minutes away. And I would get into Zazen, and I hadn't slept much, and I would just like fall asleep in Zazen. On the morning of the fourth day, I was sitting there in Zazen in the second period, and I was like sitting, and I like completely fell asleep in Zazen. And while I was sleeping, I became aware in my sleep. And I noticed I was like seated meditation, and I was conscious, but I became aware. And I kind of like, it wasn't like I heard the voice of my teacher, but it was kind of like, I had this like attitude. It's like, you're not practicing hard enough. But I became aware, and I thought, I said to myself, you're sleeping. What are you doing? It's like, you're always thinking about the past. You're always thinking about the future. You have to do this right now. And when I say right now, it's like this energy kind of like, I like absorbed this energy of my heart into my heart, and I opened my physical eyes. And I think what kind of happened was like, I opened my eyes while I was still asleep, or I just like in that place of like being half asleep and half awake, there's this energy or this spirit where I could just like absorb myself in the moment, just in Zazen, just being here right now in Zazen. And when I opened my eyes, it was like the entire universe had become a diamond. And it was like, because I had like put aside thinking of the past and put aside thinking of the future, all there was this present moment. You know, people talk about, Eckhart Tolle talks about the eternal now, or like the, you know, true reality beyond thinking. And in this kind of like the kind of delirious half asleep state, I had like really put my focus down. Like I really put it in, and it was like being struck by lightning. It was like so intense. Like I opened my eyes and I saw it was kind of like being high again on the mushrooms or something. But it was just like the most precious thing, basically, to see the present reality without discriminative thinking, without thinking about the past or thinking about the future. I got so afraid, all the adrenaline in my body just dumped, and my heart just beat so fast. It was like a car wreck. I was like absolutely freaking out. And I felt myself kind of like leaving my body, which you can do in like a lucid state. You can kind of fly out of your body. I thought I was dying. I was like, no, like, don't die, don't die. Your parents don't want you to die. They didn't send you here to die, you know? And I was like trying to get out of it. It was like, I opened this doorway, and I was like trying to get out. I didn't know how to get out, because there was no substance there to blame. It was just that I had become like aware without these like layers of thinking. And it was like so precious. And it was like this feeling of like, this is it. Like, this is it. Like, this is it. And there isn't something other than this. And so there's different ways to relate to that kind of like experience, but it was very disturbing and it wasn't pleasant. And like, I turned around, and luckily the bell like rang after that. And I turned around and I was like, man, it's like, is this what the Buddha saw? And I was like, I don't like this. Like, it wasn't like, oh, this is great. Like, this is horrible. Like, everything is like empty, you know, like everything is like without a self. It wasn't a pleasant experience. And I was depressed after that. It was very difficult. I didn't have teachers to talk to. I mean, I got through it just because my life had been like that at that point. But it was this feeling of like, you know, like, it is like this. It isn't like someplace else or something else or some enlightenment in the future or whatever. It's like this moment is supreme reality. And it's like, I don't know, it's like when we come in contact with that, it's like somehow that's part of our Zazen. And like there's something like, it's like you here now. Like there isn't somebody better or someplace better or something else better than this right now. And it was just a little moment of like experiencing and teaching. And it didn't, you know, it took me a long time to understand that. And it took me a long time to get away from it. And it took me a long time to start grasping at that, because at first it was terrifying. And then I thought, oh, I want to go back there. And it kind of ruined my Zazen trying to grasp at some special experience or some, you know, state or whatever, like something magical. It was like a benefit in kind of understanding for myself after practicing Aikido so intensely, but it was also like a huge hindrance. in that, like, I couldn't just sit zazen and just be bored or just be kind of grumpy or whatever, which is a big part of my practice now. Kicking it on time here. So that experience, it was like very precious, but also very confusing. And it caused me to seek out other spiritual teachers. Eventually, I met Karl Renz, who is a German man who's still alive and he's still giving what he calls self-talks. But he was the first person who I met that I really felt was like a spiritual master. And he demonstrated that by, he just gives these talks and you can ask him anything and he'll just like play around and he makes jokes and he kind of makes fun of people. But his idea is to kind of like shake people out of their ideas. And so he's very unconventional, kind of offensive sometimes. But he really, really changed my thinking. And it was through him, his thing is like, you are the supreme self. Like you are the true self already. And so you can't become the true self by any special experience or special advantage. And like all the experiences of self, whatever experience of enlightenment or whatever, they don't make you the self. You are the self in spite of enlightenment, in spite of anything you can experience. And he kind of talks in this realm of Ramana Maharshi, who I found out through his circle, these Indian teachers, Ramana Maharshi, Nisargadatta Maharaj. I started to learn about non-duality and kind of the teaching of the true self as awareness or not awareness, the true self as being the self same with Parabrahman, which is like the supreme. And so it's difficult to talk about and it's difficult to understand, but that it had a huge effect on me, positive and negative, in being a human. You know, it's like you can think that you're God or Parabrahman, and that seems to be what some of these gurus teach is like very important for understanding the true nature of reality. But you can also think that you're God and just be a total jerk, just total wrong. It's wrong, you know, like it's right in some ways and it's wrong, very wrong in some ways. And figuring that out is, I think that's part of Zen. And, you know, some places they say like you are the true self, or some places they say there is no self. And like figuring these things out, you know, like you can't just take one side of it, maybe. You can't lose. You can't try to escape from being human by trying to leave your body. You know, that's not right. And it's like, and that's actually the chant that we chanted earlier, the Sandokai. I think that's a little bit of what that's about. The harmony of difference, they call it. The San means duality, like being a human. Do is like oneness, like being one with everything and having no opposite and having nothing other than yourself. And being able to understand like how both of these things are true is, I think that seems to be a big part of Zen practice. I guess we end at 12:30. Okay. So here I am, 21 years old, halfway through my life. So a big, I just doing this. A big thing that happened to me, I was working as an engineer and I was struggling with this brain condition. And I went to a party one night when I was 27. And I was kind of recovering from a concussion because I've had many concussions. I was at this party and this man came up to me and he was trying to, I knew that he was gay and he was trying to see like if I was gay or something. And I was like, you know, I'm okay with gay people. I don't, you know, I've been at the San Francisco Zen Center, which is very LGBT friendly. I have gay friends. Like it's not a thing for me, but he was kind of like asking questions. And finally, like, he took me aside and he was very drunk, but he took me aside and he like held my hand. And he said like, you don't know this yet, but you're gay. And but so I don't know, when he held my hand and he said that, like I knew that he was right, and or that like that had an enormous effect on me. And like I went to sleep that night and I woke up in the middle of, I didn't scream, but it was like my life had become a nightmare, because I knew that there was something profoundly true about what he had said. And this is a little bit difficult to talk about because it's like, since that moment when I was 27, I really struggled with knowing whether I was gay or not gay. And that has been like a huge journey for me and a huge koan being kind of like a riddle. And it's hard to talk about because I don't feel, maybe when I get self-conscious, I kind of like resort to some sort of egotistical perspective where I'm trying to control who I am. But it's been interesting, these like different threads. Like I've had girlfriends, I've been like, I mean, at the time I was like, I suffered from suicidal depression after me and my girlfriend broke up. Like I had dreams about her, I had nightmares about her. Like I was depressed and then I couldn't shake it. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm gay, or I am gay, or I know that I'm gay. And, you know, my life, I couldn't figure my life out, and I couldn't make sense of it. And it was very painful because I felt enormous in retrospect. I didn't understand it at the time. I was in a really bad place at the time, but looking back, I felt enormous shame for thinking that I was gay, for thinking that was wrong, thinking that gay was wrong, thinking that loving a man was wrong, or wanting to be loved by a man was wrong. And having walked another 20 years, no, 15 years, 10 years, I've made a lot of progress with understanding myself and making peace with myself. And it's a little bit weird to begin this talk because I'm kind of still figuring out how to like make peace with myself. But that I prided myself in Aikido, like I'm doing this, like I'm, and that's something my Aikido sensei taught us, is like, if you're in this dojo, you're not second rate. You're not a second rate Aikidoist, and you're not a second rate spiritual practitioner. He didn't afford any superficiality, and he was intense, and he would lay into you. Like if you were being selfish, if you weren't obeying what he was saying as the sensei, like he would lay into you. And like, he really, a lot of people couldn't take it, but those who could, like we developed a very strong spirit and we developed a very high standard for ourselves. And so for me, in practicing like Buddhism, Aikido, learning about Ramana Maharshi, who I really regard in the utmost, if I can't accept myself for who I am, if I can't like own who I am, and if I can't make any use of these spiritual teachings, like it's not okay for me to like run for myself. And so it's been a struggle, like dealing with shame, understanding who I am, understanding like what is attraction, why I feel these different ways. And yeah, I guess it's hard for me to talk about because I can't say everything and I can't necessarily understand my life, but I'm in this place where I think I am gay, and I haven't run from that. I sat Zazen to try to get away from it. I did martial art. Maybe I have to look back on my life and ask myself, was I just doing martial arts to make myself tough or better or try to fix something about myself? Anyway, the story there's much more to the story. We've kind of run out of time here, but yeah, like I continued to practice. Then when I thought that I was gay, I moved into city center because I was seeking support, I was seeking clarity, I was trying to find some way to live. After that, I got assaulted and I got brain damage. While I was recovering from brain damage, I had a vision of Jesus Christ, which was profoundly influential for me. I had been laying, I want to tell the story. I was in San Francisco and I got brain damage. I got like slapped in a bar. It wasn't like I got punched, but I got slapped. And because I have this condition, because I was under so much stress, struggling with myself of like, I'm gay. And I had a coworker who was a man who I was in love with, or I didn't. And I was still dating women. It was a mess. And I was running from myself. I had so much stress. Somebody slapped me kind of playfully, kind of not. And I had so many concussions, but this one was different. And I couldn't recover. And like weeks went by and I couldn't recover. And I got tinnitus here. It was clear to me I had got brain damage, like permanent brain damage from that. I was in my backyard. And I was laying, I thought that I needed some kind of chemical to get into my brain to relax it. So I was taking over-the-counter sleeping medicine. I was laying in my backyard, listening to this Dharma talk on the true meaning of Christ by Vernon Howard, who was a teacher that my Aikido teacher told me to listen to. And he finished this lecture about the true meaning of Christ, on, you know, on being a good person and not being superficial. Not quite, but, and I was kind of sleeping and the Dharma talk in, and I stood up and I had this like sudden vision of that movie, Indiana Jones and the Search for the Holy Grail. And I don't want to like ruin the ending of that movie if people haven't seen it, but it kind of, at the end, the hero has to choose the cup of Christ. and there's a bad guy, there's a Nazi, and he's there and he's trying to choose the cup of Christ. And sorry if you want to hear this, plug your ears, but Nazi's got the gun, so he gets to choose first. What's the cup of Christ? So he's like, oh, this one, it's like got all the gold and jewels on it. And he's like, yes, this is the cup of Christ. And he drinks the holy water and he just instantly melts, just dies instantly. Which, interestingly, is similar to the Lakota origin story of the white buffalo calf woman. But Nazi dies instantly and he's gone. And so Indy still has to choose the cup of Christ, but he's the hero, right? He knows the Dharma. And he says, Christ was not an opulent, wealthy person. He was a carpenter. So he chooses this simple, humble cup, like doesn't look nice, made of gold, but doesn't look nice. And he drinks from the cup. And when the Nazi dies, there's the guardian there. He says, you have chosen poorly. And the Nazi melts. And he takes the cup of Christ, the symbol cup, and he drinks from the cup of Christ. And like everybody's like waiting, like, is he going to melt? And then the guardian says, you have chosen wisely. And so I stood up and I just see this scene. And I immediately, after watching it like 20 years ago as a kid, the meaning of the scene comes to me just in a flash. I was like, I get it. It's like the cup of Christ is humility. The cup of Christ is like simplicity. The cup of Christ is being okay with yourself without any external thing. You don't like without needing money or because my girlfriend had dumped me. I felt so inadequate. And I was just like beating myself to try to make more money and become more important. And I just couldn't catch up with society. And I was never good enough. I was never good enough. I couldn't make enough money to make myself good enough. I couldn't have enough success to make myself good enough. This deep feeling of inadequacy was just driving me to misery. And I understood it's like feeling whole and feeling okay with yourself just as you are. Like, is this humility that we can have? That was the teaching of Christ. And I went up to my room and I sat down at the table and I felt this like man come up behind me, like the spirit of Christ. And he said to me, I just heard there was like this thing, this like energetic transmission, this thing he said, my life, like capital L life, goes on in fearlessness, capital F fearlessness. And that fearlessness is this like relinquishing of the ego, you know, of the vanity of the ego, of feeling inadequate and then seeing the world as your enemy, you know, needing to protect yourself. And I don't know for me if that's sort of like being gay. I think, oh, like I can't be gay. Like I have to lie about myself. I have to be somebody who I'm not. That might be what my life has been. But that superficiality and vanity is this, you know, is this selfishness that I think is being pointed at in Buddhism and in Zen is like, and the Bodhisattva vow, when we put this robe on, is to practice for the sake of all sentient beings. And it's like to not practice with the three poisonous minds, greed, hatred, and delusion, but practice to want good things for all people and not want bad things for all people and to do our best. And so we're only 3/4 done with my life and we just got a little bit of time. I did a bunch of psychedelics after that. I eventually met Shohaku Okamura Roshi, who authored this book and the book that Karin has. He has defined Zen for me. Practicing with him has been just absolutely instrumental for me. My house burned down in 2018, very traumatic. I went to live at Tassajara, which was amazing. The pandemic struck. It was crazy. I couldn't keep up with it because of my brain damage. I have to sleep a lot, but Tassajara was amazing. Leaving Tassajara, I met my Lakota Red Road teacher, Abuelo Fred Vasquez. With him, I did vision quests where you go out in the forest and you sit there without any food or water for 4 days and you pray, which has been transformative for me. And in the process of this, I've deepened my understanding of Buddhism, including studying Tibetan Buddhism, learning about Gyalpo Khyentse Rinpoche. His teachings on compassion and like the true meaning of Buddhism. And, you know, like if you have a conflict with somebody, he teaches like to, rather than like wish harm for them, he teaches, you know, like find the person who you have the most difficulty with and wish good things for them. Even wish that the bad things that would happen to them would happen to you. And in that Bodhisattva vow of practicing for the sake of all sentient beings, you know, we find, I think, the true meaning of awakening and a true meaning of being, of everything being one, which is to say, like, we help each other and we support other people, and we have an ego self. Like, we have to have an ego self, but having an ego self doesn't mean that we make our lives about just about us. Like, we can make our lives about making good things for everyone. And that's tricky. Like, there's codependency and self-negligence, but in learning about Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's teaching and learning about compassion and the true meaning of Buddhism, I found like a very like sincere and pure way of practicing and living my life, and understanding that through Zen and Dogen's teachings and from all the teachers that I study from. So we just have that was the lunch, but we can go over if anybody has any questions or comments or corrections or anything, please bring them forward. Oh.
That was really wonderful. I bow to your courage and your transformations. Thank you for this talk.
I did appreciate your vulnerability as well as your, you know, diligence in your practice. I was curious, so you got Jukai with Paul Holler, but you didn't mention him. Did you have any, could you speak a little about your connection with him or what you liked about him?
Yeah, I mean, I met Paul the first time I went to City Center, and he was the abbot. So he was kind of like the abbot there when I was getting, you know, familiar with it. And I did the practice period with him at Tassajara. And so Paul is like, I mean, like, my posture in Zazen comes from Paul. Like, he has like the most exquisite Zazen posture. If you ever want to see what your spine should look like, what your posture should look like, look at him. He's an amazing person. And I haven't practiced with him in a while. And, you know, like, for me, like, Paul Haller and Okamura Roshi, I'm not a student of Okamura Roshi, but I've kind of focused my studies on his description of Zen. They have been kind of like my main Dharma teachers in some ways. But I mean, Paul has been kind of like this friend and parent figure and leader for me, and just example of like what it means to be a good person and a Dharma practitioner. Tom.
Yeah, I have talked to you before about some of this. I'm very curious about martial arts more now, I think, than maybe before, having a lawsuit leveled against me not too long ago. And also, I think the multifacets of fear, which sounds like some what your story or your talk has met in various different ways, right? And so my understanding is that it's quite hardwired in us. It comes back to our earliest existence as a form of survival, but we don't have a lot of that anymore. Yet it still retains with us, and I feel constricted by it. It sounds like you know a lot about this instinct, and if you could summarize maybe how one, as a martial artist, as a Zen practitioner, as a gay person, how you worked with this in every waking state have this come about us recently. I notice quite astutely the use of in words. This is mainly where these, it seems it meets, because I don't see this happening physically, but I see this a lot in words, and how to work with this guilt, blame, hatred, anger through language. You mentioned, maybe when we talked before, you mentioned about to recognize perhaps your reaction to this and to cultivate first these three levels of sadness and compassion and that sort of thing. Just in short, I just wanted to hear that again, I guess.
I don't say I'm probably gay, but I don't know. It's just for me, like shame. Like shame has been like fear. Fear has been huge for me, and like that's what I have this like long psychedelic journey that I went on, and it was a lot about fear, like letting go and having courage and trusting myself. For me, I've done 7 vision quests with a boil of red. I've done a lot of psychedelics. I've done all these different things. A vision quest, you just go out to the forest and you have nothing. You have no power. You have no food. You have no water. And I was sitting there this last spring. It's kind of like new, still ongoing stuff. And I was sitting there and I was just wrestling with myself. And I was just finally like, okay, like I pray to be gay. Like I pray to be gay. Like, is that what Creator wants me to pray? Like I pray to be gay. And it was just, I was sitting there and like, here, I was living at Jokoji, and we've been working on the septic system here. And I was like, we have to open up the septic tank and like all the stuff, you know, all the stuff in the septic tank, gray water. And I wasn't like sticking my hand in there, but we were like kind of wrestling with the septic system just before I did this vision quest. And I was out there in the forest, and I was just meditating and just wrestling with myself. And I had this vision, because it's a vision quest. So you could have dreams, visions, sometimes not. I had a vision of myself sitting here inside myself, kind of like as a child, sitting in a puddle of sewage. Like there was like a puddle of sewage inside myself. And I was sitting there like that's where I belonged, in this puddle of toxic shame. And that came after reading the book, Healing the Shame That Binds You, with, I forget the name of the author, but that's when just recently is when I learned about like, what's the difference between toxic shame and healthy shame, and how his view that how much toxic shame drives a great deal of human suffering, including substance abuse and all sorts of addictions. But sitting there with nothing, just helpless, and just feeling that shame inside me was just like, you see, like to heal, you have to feel like feeling that toxic shame that been at the root of my existence. And like maybe saying like, oh, I can't be gay, or I can't be this. I can't feel how I feel. I can't be a human being. I have to be Iron Man. I have to be perfect. You know, all these things, just feeling that toxic shame that told me that I couldn't be a human being, was this kind of pivotal transformative thing for me to understand that like being gay isn't shameful. Loving a man isn't shameful. It isn't shameful to be this or that, whatever you are. Like it is not shameful. And like that isn't so much about fear. Like you're saying, like it's kind of different, like the 4 levels of anger, like we had talked about. But for me, like at my core being fear, like a sense of inadequacy and a sense of shame for however it is that I am or however it is that I manifest or whatever. Those have been like real kind of key points of practice and healing and revelation of trying to find peace with myself. The 4 levels of anger, as we had talked about, is a Tibetan teaching where they say, like, this is kind of changing subjects, but for me, like, accepting myself is about fear. And I've dealt with anger and, you know, feeling inadequate. You feel like you have to fight with the whole world. But the 4 levels of anger, the surface level is like fiery anger. It's like duality, like you did this. And it can be a lot about shaming other people, like playing the shame game or a pyramid of shame. Like you did this, and I'm going to unleash fury on you. in being like burning in that hell of anger, to then say, like, if we feel more deeply, we might find that actually what we're experiencing is not anger, but we're feeling sadness. And so being able to feel that kind of like sadness or grief and like give up the dualistic views of you did this to me, you're to blame, it's all about you or whatever. We can be sad about what's going on. We can be sad about what happened. We can be sad about what we're feeling. And deeper still, from sadness, being able to feel, and Zazen gives us these things, gives us the space and the license to feel what we feel, including sadness and grief. You know, sitting Zazen, we can feel what we're feeling. And sometimes we have no choice because we're stuck there in front of a wall. Mm-hmm. Feeling what we're feeling, at least we're conscious of it. We can get it out. Deeper still than sadness, because we can wallow, we can be trapped in sadness and grief, is concern. Like we're deeply concerned, like something bad happens and we don't know if it's you or whatever, but it's a bad situation. We can be concerned and it can cause us to act or want to act. And the deepest still, what the Tibetan teaching is that the deepest level of anger is actually love, or like because we care, it's deep caring. So like we can kind of, through awareness or directly facing what we're feeling without acting or without jumping to conclusions, which is kind of our Zazen, we can get to like the deepest level of what we're feeling, which is like a deep caring for life and for other people. So we are over, but maybe we should end it. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.